Welcome to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. In this, the second of two Radio Curious interviews on human evolution, we continue our discussion with Gregory Cochran, an aerospace physicist and professor of anthropology at the University of Utah with an expertise in genetic anthropology. Gregory Cochran, along with Henry Harpending, also a professor of anthropology at the University of Utah, are the co-authors of the 2009 book, The 10,000-Year Explosion, How Civilization Accelerated Human Evolution. This book explores how humans appear to have evolved over the last 10,000 years, largely driven by civilization, the place, the culture, and the lifestyle of the time. In this second conversation, recorded by phone with Gregory Cochran from his home in Albuquerque, New Mexico, on February 23, 2009, we discuss how humans have genetically evolved. In part one, we discuss the changes in human biology, such as lactose tolerance and resistance to malaria, that represent human evolution accelerated by civilization. We also discuss the intermixings of Neanderthals and humans and the genetic benefits in our species that continue to this day. We continue in this visit to explore how humans appear to have evolved over the last 10,000 years. We discuss how gene mutations have allowed specific human advantages in different locations around the world. We began with his discussion of the migration of the human species out of Africa, which resulted in people living in northern latitudes. People born in these areas with a random genetic mutation, resulting in a skin of a lighter color, allowed them to absorb more vitamin D from the sun, thus giving them better health and a greater opportunity to have offspring. We also discussed the genetic mutations that contribute to certain types of intelligence.
One we now know a fair amount about fairly recently. We probably learned almost all of this in the last 3 years. We now know that it's a complex system that gives you dark skin to protect against ultraviolet rays and other things. And that among people, and originally, all humans have this version because all humans appear to have lived in Africa, let's say a little before 50,000 years ago, all modern humans. And as they expanded, they moved into places where the conditions were different, Europe, for example, or North Asia. And what happened is that for some reason, and we have reasonable guesses, but we don't know for sure, it was actually advantageous to be paler in these places. It's quite possible that being pale paid off in terms of letting you get more vitamin D, since you get vitamin D from sunlight hitting your skin. And there is less... There's less ultraviolet, the type of sunlight you need in these places. It may mean you needed a paler skin. There's other possibilities too, but this is probably the main hypothesis for why. And so what you had was, mutated versions of some of the genes that are involved in this system that makes dark pigment for the skin occurred and then became common with fairly rapidly. One of them appears to also give you blue eyes. It makes your skin somewhat lighter, and it makes your eyes blue. That one appears to be less than 10,000 years old. It's spread to become common in some parts of Europe. But if you go, to Asia or Africa, you won't find it. We know about 5 or 6 genes like this in Europe, which together probably are most of the explanation for light skin in Europe. And most of them appear to have changed fairly recently, certainly after people moved out of Africa, and some of them in less than 10,000 years. Now, in China, North China, people have fairly light skin, but they have achieved it in a completely different way.
What is the difference?
Different mutations, and often different genes have changed.
But originally for the same result, so that more vitamin D could reach the body corpus.
Possibly, possibly, but there are other possibilities. I mean, let's suppose that you have a gene that is involved in the system of making melanin, but it does something else as well. Many genes have more than one function. Now, it might be that in the past, that gene really couldn't change because it had to do things in a certain way to produce melanin, by the way, if you don't have enough melanin and you live in the tropics, you're in deep trouble. You'll get skin cancer and other problems. But it might be that made it hard to improve that second function because it was, you know, very constrained by what it had to do in the melanin pathway. So if once you're living, let's say in Ireland, someplace cool and misty with very little ultraviolet, it might be that gene is now free to change in some way that improves that second function, whatever it is. It might also give you vitamin D. It might even give you advantage two ways. But there's at least a possibility that there are other things that are changing. You know, there's other ways in which this pays off other than just vitamin D. One of the reasons I sort of suspect this is because often the genes that mutated are just different in China and Europe. And you'd think that if all you had to do was knock out that gene to get an advantage, you'd think that it would happen both places, because there's a lot of different ways to knock out a gene. But I could be wrong.
As further understanding of DNA reveals itself, do you foresee answers to these questions as to why?
Eventually, although some of them may be tricky. I mean, it's going to be particularly tricky if this was an advantage that just doesn't exist at all anymore. What if there was a disease running around in Europe 10,000 years ago, one that is not there anymore? And a certain mutation protected you against it and became common, and maybe it's still common. But if the disease is not there, it's going to be kind of tricky figuring it out. I can tell you one example, which probably is like that. People have recently noticed that they're starting to see black wolves in places like Canada, and wolves used to never be black. And what it turns out is there's a mutated gene, which they had picked up from dogs, but somehow it works very well, and it spread much more than typical dog genes have among wolves. And this gene gives them dark fur. But by looking at the biochemistry, there's a strong suspicion this gene is involved in protecting against some disease because it affects the immune system as well as skin color, coat color. So, if this happened far enough in the past and the world has simply changed, we might have trouble figuring out. But I think we'll probably figure out most of it.
You also make reference in your book, The 10,000-Year Explosion, to the change in the size of skulls of people who lived in England.
Well, that one's interesting. There are sort of two things here. One is, over the longer period, human skulls have shrunk. Say, they probably reached their biggest something like 15,000 years ago, just before the end of the Ice Age, and since then, they've shrunk in almost every population, maybe not every population, by something like 10%. You know, the skull has shrunk. This is good evidence that change is happening. It doesn't tell you exactly why, but there's no doubt that the change has happened. But there's reason to think that this change has continued. For example, there are skull features which today are very rare in Europe, but they weren't so rare 3,000 years ago.
What are those features?
Well, brow ridges, for example, sort of, you know, strong. Sort of a little bump of bone, you know, more than a little over the eyes. Australian Aborigines still have this, but it used to be, 3,000 years ago, it was moderately, maybe 10% or 5% of Europeans had it. 20,000 years ago, a lot of Europeans had it. It's almost gone now. It's decreased somewhat in Australia, but the point is these things have changed. But the one you mentioned, there's some indication that this change may have continued even in the last 1,000 years when people were comparing skulls of people who died back in the Black Death with skulls today, their shape is somewhat different.
Now, what would be the cause of this change? Would that be sexual selection within an island population or something else?
Well, this change is not just in England. I mean, it's happened if you look for skulls that are sort of 4,000 or 5,000 years old, they're sturdier, they're heavier, they're a bit different in Germany as well and other places where people have looked. Could it be sexual selection, which is to say, is this, sometimes you could have something, if women like a given thing or men like a given thing, could you eventually get more of it? I said, it's possible. But it's also, some of these things, the fact that it happens everywhere in the world starting 10,000 years ago makes me think it's not sexual selection, it's something else. Maybe it's temperature. I mean, the world got warmer, And there is a general tendency for brains to be larger in the coolest parts of the world, in populations that have lived there a long time. Eskimos have pretty large brains for their size compared to other people.
Is there an understanding as to why?
Probably not entirely. There are, I'd say there is some ideas. I wouldn't call it understanding. One reason is probably because, you know, there are some problems with, you know, if you get too hot, for example, you will get a heat stroke or something. And the brain generates a lot of uses a lot of energy and therefore generates a lot of heat. It may be that you need to worry about this less in a cool climate, which is, in other words, it might, all else equal, it might be sort of an advantage to have a bigger brain. If you could do that without having to worry about getting too hot, maybe that's why, but I'm not sure why. But it's a known trend.
Well, there are a couple of variables in there. One would be the size of the infant being born. Could it pass through the birth canal?
That's a difficulty, certainly.
And another is intelligence. It seems to be
pull in different directions.
Yeah, it seems to be that the larger the brain, the greater capacity for intelligence.
That is the case, although it is not super simple. I mean, for example, suppose you look at IQ scores and brain sizes in humans today, you'll find there is a correlation. But it isn't one-to-one. I mean, it's not automatically true that somebody's smarter who has a larger brain. There's a general tendency that way. There's a correlation that probably explains about a fifth or something of the variation we see in IQ. So, I mean, it matters, but it's not the whole story. I mean, there's other things. It may be that the speed of nervous propagation, the way in which the brain is organized, the extent of connection, I mean, there's a lot of other things that might vary. So it's, you know, if somebody, for example, starts bragging about his hat size, he's a little premature, but there is a relationship, and there would almost have to be, because suppose you could get everything done with a brain that was much smaller, then people who had that brain would have a big advantage, because they would need less energy to run it, and I'll tell you, birth would be a lot easier for a population like that. I mean, today, you can, you know, human brains, the human skulls, or baby skulls, are just about as big as mothers can stand. Birth is not, you know, a terribly easy process. If they shrank 20%, it'd be much easier. So if you could, if there was no payoff to a large brain, you'd expect them to be smaller. So that suggests there must be a payoff. And again, studies show that there is some.
So on the continuum of human evolution, maybe in 15 or 20,000 years, we might see a difference.
Well, we know that it's changed. For sure, and it's gone down in the last 15. If it goes down that much again, we'll be back down with Homo erectus. One suspects that might not be so good, but there have been other changes in between, and there's also been probably regional changes, depending on, you know, the local payoff, you know, the local expenses, that sort of thing. There's, you know, these trends. Some of them are the same everywhere. Some of them vary from place to place. It all depends on where how the environment changes.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting with Gregory Cochran from his home in Albuquerque, New Mexico. He's the co-author of The 10,000-Year Explosion, How Civilization Accelerated Human Evolution. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Gregory, one of the isolated groups of people that you address in The 10,000-Year Explosion, How Civilization Accelerated Human Evolution, is the Jewish people of Ashkenazi origin. And your research indicates that there's a higher intelligence quotient than among the larger selection, the larger group of people worldwide.
Yeah.
Can you explain that, elaborate on that?
Well, the first is, you know, is there good evidence that that is the case? And we have some IQ test results, and probably a typical score is something like 112, whereas the typical European average is more like 100. But there's also a tremendous amount of high intellectual achievement, which is something you might expect to see more of in a group with a higher average IQ, such as people winning, Ashkenazi Jews, European Jews, winning about a quarter of the Nobel Science prizes, highly represented in mathematics. I mean, I could talk about things like literature, but then we talk about, you know, opinions more as to, you know, what's really good and what's really not. In science and mathematics, there's not so much disagreement about, you know, whether somebody's really achieved. So I tend to stick to that. It's also an area I know fairly well.
So what brought this about?
what we think happened, and this is, you know, this is not proven beyond a shadow of a doubt, but we think it was natural selection that favored people with higher IQs had more children over a period of about 1,000 years, covering most of the Middle Ages. And at the same time, with other special circumstances, that the sort of that meant that this was possible because they had a very unusual mix of jobs that depended more heavily on IQ than the typical job. The typical job being a small farmer for most people, most other groups. And also another special pattern was that they had very low rates of, at least after a while, they had very low rates of intermarriage with their neighbors. And if you end up, you know, for a process like this to make a group different, the group has to intermarry at a low rate. If it intermarries a lot, they'll be like their neighbors. And it doesn't take too much for that to be true. If you married 10% of the time with your neighbors, you would inevitably be very much like them. So we have a situation in which a group that did very, very little intermarriage, had a special set of jobs, was in a situation where doing well at those jobs led to higher incomes and larger and considerably larger families. That's another thing which has changed in the present. Typically, people who have the most money are not famous for having the most kids today. But for most of the Middle Ages, that was true, and not just in the Jews, but in all essentially all groups in Europe and in many other parts of the world, places like China as well. People raised more kids if they were wealthier. Today, it's not so much that way.
So staying with the Ashkenazi Jews in North Central Europe, how long ago did they live there?
Well, they sort of started around the year 800 in the Rhineland, and then later sometimes moved, sometimes were pushed to various other places, on the whole moving towards Central and Eastern Europe from Western Europe originally. So this group was living there basically from around 800 or a little after to, well, basically up to the 20th century when Hitler, of course, had, you know, killed most of them or drove them out. So we're talking more than 1,000 years.
And they were culturally self-contained by the desire of the group and by the desire of non-members of the group.
Yeah, that's pretty much true. One of the reasons they appear to have stayed particularly self-contained in Eastern Europe is Eastern Europe was typically less developed than Western Europe. And there's in Jewish history, there tends to be sort of a tendency to be more interested in the outside culture when it's, say, advanced and looks impressive. And I think they didn't consider that particularly true in 1400 in Poland or in Russia. But they were surprisingly self-contained. I mean, to the point where, for example, in probably in 1900, probably the average Jew in Poland really wasn't very fluent in Polish.
What was their language?
Yiddish, which is a mix of several things, originally probably German, mixed with Hebrew, many Hebrew words, and a spattering of other things, such as some Slavic words. At least that's my best impression of it. I'm not a trained linguist, but it's something like that.
In your experience studying this issue and isolated cultures, have you found similar groups that have had what you believe is a greater intelligence level?
I would say the answer is maybe, but I'm not at all confident of it. You need special situations. First, you need to be genetically isolated from other people, and in Europe, that wasn't very common. I mean, there were really only two groups that were genetically isolated from other people. Probably maybe only the Jews. By the way, not completely and always. It appears in early days of the Jewish founding populations in Europe, there was more mixture. If you look at them, they have quite a bit of European admixture, but you can also tell it's not recent. It might have been back in Roman times. Some of these rules that you know, banned intermarriage both within the Jewish community and pressure from outside, some of those rules really only developed later. So that, you know, the lack of intermarriage is unusual. The occupational specialization is unusual. I don't think there's any other group like this in Europe. There might be in India. In India, you know, all sorts of groups are sort with the caste system. People have, you know, split into different groups that have, on average, different occupations. And at least moderately low intermarriage, it's at least possible something like this has happened in some Indian caste. But there's no overwhelming, or in some group that was sort of like that, such as the Parsis in India, which is not technically a caste, but was sort of treated as if they were. They're really a separate group of a separate religion other than Hinduism, Zoroastrianism. It could have happened, but I don't think we have any strong evidence on it.
Within the Jewish group, there was a development of serious diseases that would kill children at 2 or 3 years old, like Tay-Sachs.
Some of them, yes.
Did you find any of those in the Indian population, diseases?
I'm not aware of them, but I might not know. I mean, as I said, we think that those mutations became common because they had advantages for carriers. It's hard, and when we do analysis of it, we can't see how they could become common elsewise. But and some of them look biochemically as if they might have increased intelligence, Tay-Sachs, for example, in a carrier. In India, I'm not aware of any kind of information like that, but I might not know. I mean, one of the reasons that this study was possible is there's been a lot of investigation of Jewish medical genetics. There hasn't been the same degree of investigation of these groups in India, although that data may be accumulating. But the point is, it's not done yet. The Parsis, for example, I know some accounts that they have certain things that make you wonder. They have a high frequency of breast cancer. They have a high frequency of Parkinson's disease, which is, you know, could tell you something neurological is going on.
This is the Ashkenazi group.
No, this is the Parsi group in India. But I don't think we know enough to say anything, really. The reason we talk about the Parsis at all is because they're very accomplished, considering their numbers. They're very prominent. But at the same time, their numbers are not large at all. There are less than 100,000 of them in the world. But they're very prominent in India in commerce and intellectually. It's enough so that some of them have been heard of outside of India. Not a lot. Again, we're only talking about 70,000 people. But, you know, Zubin Mehta was Parsi. Freddie Mercury was Parsi.
Going back to Tay-Sachs, you mentioned that would have a possible link to increased intelligence. What would that be?
Well, the reason that we suspect that is, first, it's both deadly enough and common enough that it needs some explanation. The second reason is that when you look at the details of what it does biochemically, it causes the buildup of a compound. This is the compound that acts as a messenger that makes nerve cells grow more little branches, dendrites. Now, in the actual sick children, they exhibit this, but it's not one that makes them smarter. Stuff is building up until it destroys those nerve cells. But in a carrier, you wouldn't have this tremendous buildup. You'd only have a slight increase in this compound, and most recently, you'd expect to see a few more dendrites. And that might be something that could be positive, at least in some situations. And it's the sort of thing that looks like what you might see in something that increased intelligence, more connections.
Well, Gregory Cochran, author of The 10,000-Year Explosion, How Civilization Accelerated Human Evolution, I want to thank you for being with us on this second part of our conversation and again ask you our signature questions. Is there a new fact or idea or concept that you can share with us that you've learned recently?
Well, there have been a couple facts that along a certain trend that I've been interested in for years. Some work I used to do and still do occasionally with Paul Ewald on the evolution of infectious disease. We were predicting years ago that quite a few diseases would have subtle ways in which germs contributed to them or viruses that were not yet discovered. And there's been a couple in the last year that may fit into that. One, there's starting to be some evidence that a particular fairly common virus may be involved in the nastiest kind of brain cancer, glioblastoma, and that virus being cytomegalovirus, which is unfortunately in the news, for example, because Senator Kennedy has this. And I know more about it than I want to from friends. Anyhow, if this is the case, if this virus is involved in the cause of it, this could be a good thing for the future. We might be able to do something about preventing it. And that would be the fact that I find particularly interesting, because this is something I care about. The book?
Yeah, tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately.
Yeah. Well, I haven't read this book completely, and I suspect it's going to take me about 2 or 3 years to finish it, because it's sort of overwhelming. But this is a new book called The Princeton Companion to Mathematics. And it's written by people, you know, by many people who are absolutely top-notch in their fields, people who have won the highest awards in mathematics, in many cases, the Fields Medal. And I once had a bachelor's in mathematics as well as in physics, and I used to think I knew some math. But this book is a good correction to realize how much there is to know, how little I ever learned, and how no human being's ever going to know all of it ever again. Uh, it's it just sort of shows the size and the power and the fascination of modern mathematics. No one would have to read all of it, but a lot of people would find something interesting in it.
Is there an author or a lead author in what sounds like a compilation of...
The editor is Timothy Gowers, G-O-W-E-R-S, who is himself, of course, a Fields Medalist, and it has many other people in here. The Princeton Companion to Mathematics, which is, I think, Princeton University Press.
Well, Gregory Cochran, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
Thank you.
Gregory Cochran is an aerospace physicist and professor of anthropology at the University of Utah. His expertise is in genetic anthropology. Gregory Cochran, along with Henry Harpending, also a professor of anthropology at the University of Utah, is the co-author of The 10,000-Year Explosion, How Civilization Accelerated Human Evolution. The website to their book is the10,000yearexplosion.com. The book Gregory Cochran recommends is The Princeton Companion to Mathematics, edited by Timothy Gowers, G-O-W-E-R-S. This program was the second of a two-part interview recorded on February 23rd, 2009. There are over 500 archive editions of Radio Curious on our website, www.radiocurious.org, where they're free for you to stream, download, enjoy, and share. We appreciate your curiosity, ideas, comments, and questions. You may reach us by email. Our address is curious@radiocurious.org or snailmail 280 North Oak Street, Ukiah, that's U-K-I-A-H, California 95482, or by phone 707-462-6541. You've been listening to Radio Curious. Christina Onnestad is our associate producer, and I'm host and producer, Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.